You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
What is the most surprising thing for you about this job you have?
I think the size, the magnitude of everything.
President Donald Trump's third week in the White House. Was it much improvement on the first two? My guests Tom Edwards and Daniel Giacopelli will be here to answer that and other rhetorical questions, including, is an anti-terror barricade around the Eiffel Tower really necessary? Why are the Dutch having such a hard time filling their prisons? And
baby, I got no gas. Oh yeah.
Why was Prince so determined to keep his music off streaming services? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle 24's Tom Edwards and Daniel Giacopelli. Welcome both. We have now endured 21 days of the presidency of Donald Trump, just 1,440 more to go. His third week in the White House adhered pretty much to the template established by the first two, i.e. a mix of avoidable bungling and pointless belligerence. Among other highlights, he used his Twitter account to complain about a department store dropping his daughter's fashion range, broadcast a dubious poll backing his botched immigration reform in which the numbers added up to 101%, and threatened in full-fledged caps lock apoplexy, see you in court, to judges who will be in court anyway. Tom, at this point, if we have not already, do we have to give up on any remaining hope that Trump the president will differ from Trump the campaigner?
I think we should give up on that. I think we're seeing daily the fact that the promise of the campaign, and I use that phrase flexibly, is being realized day to day. I thought it was interesting, the clip we had at the top of the show with Trump talking about the magnitude of government and that being something that had wrong-footed him. I think the takeaway definitely from this week is the scale of the operation, whether it's the scale of the conviction you need to bring even quite a warped agenda forwards, whether it's the scale in terms of the numbers of people you need to physically staff just the White House, far less all of the workings of government. We're seeing enough signs that Trump, with that bellicose manner that you described, Andrew, isn't equipped to play that game over how many days was it you mentioned?
21.
Well, no, and the remaining 1,000.
Well, the 21 we've had feels like 1,440.
So I actually take some comfort counterintuitively from the fact that the scale of the task in front of him, in a way, it seems to become bigger with each passing day. And I wonder whether that will do for him. I just can't see us having this conversation right the way through till 2020.
Well, the thing is, he's a 70-year-old man. How many 70-year-old men do you know change their personalities overnight?
Andrew Muller?
Especially ones who are egotistical and or vain when they're given an immense amount of power.
I'm right here.
Who among them would change for the better? So no, we're not going to have a different person at all. I mean, he's going to be the same old Donald Trump. And Sean Spicer has said that as such this week. He said Trump will be Trump. He's not going to change. He voices his opinion. That's who he is.
But Danny, the key shtick of his campaign was that he was the outsider, and coupled with that, he leavened in a fairly hefty serving of persecution complex as well. They're all out to get me. The establishment are trying to keep me down, and by extension, my voters. How long can you pull that one off when you are not merely a billionaire property developer with his own solid gold elevator, but also president of the United Actual States? How long can he really keep credibly whining that he's an outsider, that he's being kept away from things and everyone's out to get him?
I think a long time.
Good.
It matters really about his supporters, the people who voted for him, how long he can convince them that what he's doing is right. You know, he made a lot of campaign promises. He made, I think, hundreds of campaign promises. But how many do you really remember? You remember the wall. You remember the Muslim ban. That's about it. If you know, if we can't remember his promises, probably a lot of his supporters can't remember the promises. So he could break those promises easily. And there you go.
I beg to differ with Danny on one crucial respect. Now, I agree that there's probably a core Trump demographic. Who knows what it is in terms of the proportion of the overall population? 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%? I'm not sure.
We have learned today, sorry to cut you off mid-thought, but we have learned today, and I suspect this is going to reinforce the point you're about to make, that fully, hang on, where is it? 51% of Trump voters believe that his immigration policies are justified by the Bowling Green massacre.
Well, this is it. So that shows that a lot of these people are
which
probably...
Which we have to say on the show, that didn't happen.
Coming out of left field. What none of these polls, though, take into account, and I think this is critical, is that even the most swivel-eyed loons of within that 51%, and they would be hopefully quite a small proportion, don't like incompetence in the White House. And the point is, it doesn't matter whether he honours or dishonours his pledges, whether the people around him in that immediate cabal chop or change. In the end, he will be hamstrung by incompetence. The most enthusiastic Trump supporter is simply not going to weather incompetence on a scale we've already been witnessing over an entire political term. And I can see, Danny, you're shaking your head. I understand they'll try and change the narrative and present failures as successes and so on. But in the end, it will filter down to people in a far too immediate way, whether it's about Medicare, whether it's the fact that jobs don't return that we're going to return and all this kind of thing. They'll get found out by not being up to the task. Well, and it will happen, I'm sure, sooner than Trump hopes it will.
This is true, is it not, though, Danny? Because Trump supporters, I suspect, thought they'd elected a kind of ass-kicking, name-taking, deal-making, getting-stuff-done, pragmatist buccaneer type, and not, you know, the Marx Brothers movie we've had for the last 3 weeks. Is there a point at which patience is going to start to dwindle?
Yeah, but you say, you know, he looks like a buffoon, but not to the people who read the magazines who say he's doing a great job. I mean, it all depends on the echo chamber in which you live. For Trump supporters, he's done a great job. I mean, I've seen interviews with Trump supporters. They say he's been a maverick. He's doing well. I approve of what he's doing. But, I mean, if you read Breitbart, Trump's the best president who ever lived. So it all depends.
But on that note, approval ratings for his cabinet picks and cronies are spectacular, by which I mean they're horrible. DeVos 27%, Bannon 22%, Spicer 32%, Conway 34%. Can he keep running against that, can he keep buying more and more time by sacking one bunch of dingbats and buffoons and importing another bunch of dingbats
and
buffoons? Well,
he knows that it looks bad, all the kind of infighting and everything. I mean, in the Politico piece I read today, he's well aware, but he's kind of holding off on doing a massive staff restructuring so early because it looks bad when you have to sack your entire staff three weeks into the presidency.
He'll call it a restructuring as well, won't
exactly.
he?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Andrew, can I sort of say in answer to some critics who maybe even will get in contact with us here and say, well, hang on a minute, we're tired of this constant Trump bashing, give the man a chance, you know, you're out of touch, you're in the metropolitan elite bubble of Western Europe, etc., etc., etc. Absolutely. Let's judge on the performance of his administration. And that's why I think, despite what Danny says, and I agree with him to a degree, that your Breitbarts and your pro-Trump media organizations will continue to sell the dream, that the number of people who will be swayed by that will dwindle. I'm very confident of it.
Okay, well, let's move along now, but maintain somewhat the theme of vainglorious attempts to protect a nation from terrorism. France is to take measures to deter attacks upon the world's favourite pylon, announcing plans to surround the Eiffel Tower with a 2.5-metre-tall glass barrier at its base. But are they just spending 20 million euros on making it more likely that terrorists will blow up something else instead? That question exactly, Tom. In a city with as many targets as Paris has, as many sort of globally famous, relatively unprotected, certainly newsworthy targets, is there any point in doing this?
I think there is a point in ensuring that as far as you can and within a reasonable amount of expenditure, you make it as difficult as possible to cause mayhem. And let me explain what I mean by that. In London, many key sites of historical or public or social significance are protected sort of tacitly by bits of cleverly designed street furniture, for example. So
things that look like concrete benches are often actual...
It may be a traffic bollard or a bus shelter, and it's actually fulfilling a strategic function. Now, to my way of thinking, that's a much more intelligent and intuitive way to defend your city, because I agree with you. You can never defend all of the city all of the time. And I think if there's a mistake that's been made here, it's not the outlay, which is, I would say, broadly reasonable for a city that's so dependent on tourism for its economic general robustness. I think it's to make a big play of a thing at a site. I think you're much better served by integrating the defences into the rest of your street furniture. And I have to say, I think actually London, and the City of London in particular, has always done a very good job of doing that.
I think it has, and it does such a good job that, I mean, I didn't realise myself, in fact, until I did a story about this for Monocle magazine a few months ago, that a lot of places where you go in London where there's things like concrete benches or sort of fixed picnic areas are in fact there to stop vehicle bombs.
It's pretty controversial too. I mean, defensive architecture, it could also be used to kind of make homeless people not sleep on a bench, for instance. I mean, it's subtle ways that you make the urban fabric opposing other
but
people.
But aren't these nudges, Danny? These are this kind of idea of nudging or guiding people in the direction you want them to behave or to walk or not to behave or not to walk.
To be fair, this is not that,
though.
The
new fabric of a city.
This is a renovation of the Eiffel Tower that's a third of a billion euros that they're spending, and this is 20 million euros is on security. I mean, it's not that outlandish. And just because you're defending it doesn't mean that, you know, you're not defending other places, for instance. I mean, but I suppose you're going to say, does this mean you have to protect every single target?
Which you can't. But even in and of itself, Tom, do the defences actually work? I mean, the obvious illustration of the degree to which this is a bit like stamping on mercury, I guess, is that they put those big, well, the initial big fences they put up at Downing Street in 1989 for fear of vehicle-borne bombs driven by the IRA. And 2 years later, of course, the IRA launched mortars over the fences into Downing Street from a van parked on Whitehall, if memory serves. I mean, my point being, if you in this respect, if you build a better mousetrap, the world will eventually build a better mouse.
I think that's true to a degree, though you could flip that around, Andrew, and say, well, that precisely proves the point. You know, those mortars inflicted some damage, but it wasn't critical.
It could have been a lot worse than a
lorry bomb parked right outside would have done. So, yeah, I mean, I see your point. I just think you're better off doing these things, not surreptitiously, because I know people are uneasy about, as Danny alluded to, the idea that, you know, state apparatus are manipulating the very fabric of our cities and changing them and changing our behaviour. But I think there's a middle ground to strike. And I think the risk maybe is that if you try and announce an initiative like this to some fanfare, yeah, your next diehard lone wolf madman have a go, you know, run at a heavily armed soldier with a knife hero, maybe thinks this is the next best option. I'm not saying it makes that more likely, but it might give the wrong kind of people that sort of idea.
The thing that always strikes me about these things as well is that even if they are erected in response to what is hopefully a temporary menace, like, say, as the IRA sort of proved to be, and that hopefully the modern Islamist jihad is, they become almost by definition permanent, though, don't they, Danny? Because no politician wants to be the one who takes the risk of saying, actually, you know what? I think this is over. Let's take it all down.
Well, I don't know. I mean, well, can you recall any time when some defensive structure was taken down after a threat dissolved? I mean, what about the IRA stuff? The concrete? I suppose that's still around.
It's all still there.
It's still in the City of London.
There's no litter bins on the whole of the London Underground network, for example, which was originally...
That was after the Victoria Station bombing, I think. Those were removed.
And the Berlin Wall came down.
That wasn't really an anti-terrorist measure.
That was to keep people in
rather than keep them out.
Yeah, but it was still a structure, kind of a security structure that was taken down after a threat ceased to be a threat. You know, this, I think we're making a little bit more of a bigger deal than we need to about these things. This is kind of their renovating temporary fences that were put up essentially for a football tournament, and they're putting a slightly stronger, more elegant structure
in its place. I kind of agree with Andrew, though. The problem is with these things, these things take on an air of permanence. If you look around, say, the Palace of Westminster and the Houses of Parliament, if you know that road, you used to be able to stroll around freely. It's really ugly now. It's a mess. There's concrete bollards everywhere.
Horrible.
And they've kind of assumed a greater permanence as each year has passed. I'm sure there's a more elegant way of designing that that plaza, that road that runs next to the river and then sort of around the back of the Houses of Parliament. And, you know, this is the thing, Danny. What about one's freedom to view one city unencumbered by, you know, counter-terror measures?
Well, for instance, I think in the Statue of Liberty, you at some point you couldn't go into the Crown, and now you can. So that was brought back after they deemed some threat was a little bit less than a threat. You can now go to the top of the Statue of Liberty.
Wasn't that a structural issue with the Statue of Liberty?
No, it was a security thing.
Okay.
Well, we'll be fact-checked after this, but I'm almost entirely positive that was a terrorism thing.
A final thought on this new Eiffel Tower thing, Tom. There, it pains to suggest that it's going to be transparent, as glass, presumably fairly thick armored glass, is going to be. But at what point do these things, which are obviously at some level designed not merely to deter actual attacks but to make the citizens feel safe, at what point do they start making citizens feel the opposite? I mean, when I've reported from places where there literally are armoured vehicles and police on every corner and soldiers everywhere, I don't feel more safe.
Well, no, and Andrew, this is that old cliche about security theatre, isn't it? We've been there before in airports where these full body screening devices that, as it turns out, are essentially no better than the traditional sort of pat down. But the idea is that the appearance of technology makes people feel better. I'd be surprised in this case if this fills, I don't know, the French public or visiting tourists and holidaymakers with a great deal more confidence. And I just think cities or municipalities or whoever's making the decision, they should tread carefully. And I always think that, a more discreet solution, if available, is the best option.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Tom Edwards and Daniel Giacopelli. Coming up next, the Netherlands prisons are routinely praised or condemned as among the most comfortable and liberal in the world. So why can't they fill them?
Can you smell that popcorn? Well, while you're waiting in line, let me tell you about some of the standout guests we've spoken to recently on The Cinema Show. This year's Palme d'Or winner Ken Loach told us how going back to basics was integral to the strength of his winning film, I, Daniel Blake.
Paul wrote two characters which have quite simple, straightforward situations.
Fellow Palme d'Or winners Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne told us how reaching the heights of the film industry can have its downside.
Because after Cannes, the reactions were mixed. Some good, some less good.
And Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan gave me a glimpse into his creative process.
What matters in making movies is all the elements are working and walking at once in synchronicity.
So now you've heard the trailer, all you need is the main attraction. Tune in to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 every Friday at 20:00 in London. Or download the podcast now. You'd better hurry with that popcorn though. The movie's about to start.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still here are Tom Edwards and Daniel Giacopelli. Now, it is common among the hanging and flogging tendency of British and American conservatism to depict the liberal democracies of Northern Europe as permissive free-for-alls, decadently indulgent of crime and the causes thereof. The proverbially liberal Netherlands is often the focus of such abuse. Its prisons, it will be sourly muttered, are like holiday camps. It turns out, however, that nobody appears to want to live in them. The Netherlands will close 5 more prisons this year after shutting 19 in 2014. Despite renting some spare cells out to house the miscreants and ne'er-do-wells of neighbouring countries, the Netherlands cannot fill their jails. Tom, is this the Dutch doing something right or wrong?
Well, Andrew, I thought, if you'll allow me, that I'd start with a quote. I've done a bit of research today. And I was looking at this because it struck me as rather interesting. And I'm going to quote from Professor of Criminology, René van Swanningham, a Dutchman. And this is slightly paraphrased. Unlike the US, where the focus on these matters is on moral arguments, the Dutch focus on what works.
That's crazy.
I know. What a crazy idea, right? So
fact-based policies.
They actually look at what works in terms of preventing crime, rehabilitation for those who do offend, the general safety of society. And they make their policies, as Danny said, a crazy idea, based on that shocking conclusion. And
whereas in my country, we like our vengeance and justice served cold, Tom. You do the crime, you pay the time.
Which is why, and I've done a bit of research myself.
Wow, what's happened to Midori House this week?
Facts and quotations.
Which is why the Dutch currently have an incarceration rate of 69 per 100,000 people. Danny, do you know roughly out of every 100,000 of your fellow citizens are currently doing porridge?
716.
Absolutely spot on.
I'm so good on.
Well done.
The thing is, justice in the U.S. is tinged with morality. So it has nothing, and we might get letters from...
You're calling the Dutch amoral, aren't you?
They focus on rehabilitation. And in the U.S., it's kind of, it's justice that is vengeance. It's kind of, you do the time because you did a bad thing. If you get rehabilitated when you leave prison in the U.S., that's a good thing, but it's not the main point of prison in the U.S.,
Tom, it was, I think, was Douglas Hurd Home Secretary? I think he was. He once described prison as an expensive way of making bad people worse. But that argument's never taken hold in Britain either, which does still have that sort of hang them, flog them mentality, doesn't it?
It does. I think there's a clear conflict in this country. I don't think we have as many people who so readily view this as a simply and purely moral question as Danny suggests in the US, and the numbers certainly back that up. Look, we've got a real problem in this country. Our prisons are overcrowded, reoffending rates are astonishing, many petty offenders go on to commit far worse crimes after they've had a spell within the prison system. So I think it's deeply flawed. I don't know. In Britain, I think it's complex. I'd like to see us push much more aggressively towards the, what would you call it, the Benelux model, if you like, and keep people out of prison. You know, we're jailing mothers with young children. We're jailing people for first offences on minor thefts. You know, I cannot see that a society that's really interested in the betterment of all can justify that at the cost that are involved.
The cost, exactly. I mean, just a final quick thought on this one, Danny. Could you sell this to Americans on the basis of cost? Your country spends fantastic amounts of money jailing fantastic numbers of people for really no appreciable gain.
Yeah, I mean, well, the big trend in the U.S. is now, of course, private prisons, which is insanely controversial and very morally dubious. You know, you're essentially privatizing a core government function. And the idea there is because it's cheaper and more efficient.
Of course it's cheaper when you need to additionally pay somebody a dividend.
Yeah, exactly. So they obviously have a profit incentive to jail people, which is itself, you know, rather crazy. So maybe that would be the argument to convince Americans. I mean, it's a cost-cutting thing. I mean, I can't see this working in the U.S.
Okay, well, finally tonight, some music. Prince, obviously. His death last April also marked the end of one of the last significant stands against the modern reality of the music business. Prince had obstinately withheld his music from streaming services, as well as aggressively pursuing those who put his music online without authorization. That will change from Sunday, when that entire extraordinary catalogue assembled by Prince will appear on Spotify, Apple, and Napster. The decision appears related to the almighty tax bill about to descend on his estate's executors. Also joining us for this final story is Monocle's associate producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, what do we make now of Prince's stand against streaming? Was he the proverbial King Canute standing on the beach railing at the incoming tide with a broom, or was there something noble about it?
I think there was something noble about it. And, you know, Prince has the power, so he has to use it. I mean, I think he didn't think it's beautiful to listen to his music in a streaming service. He likes someone buying a CD or even downloading on iTunes. So, I mean, if he can, because I think a lot of artists can't do that because, you know, otherwise they would be poor, they wouldn't have money. But I think Prince managed to be the ninth best-selling artist of 2016, and he didn't need streaming services for that. So I can actually associate, I can understand why Prince did that, in a way.
But it wasn't just that he thought it was a non-beautiful way to consume music, though, was it? It was also the fact that musicians get paid absolute beans, even if their music is streamed in prodigious quantities, as Prince's doubtless will be.
Absolutely, and I totally agree with you, Andrew. I think there's a generation today that thinks entertainment should come for free. They're a bit pampered, and it doesn't only come from music, but it's also happening in the film industry, in the TV industry, even with magazines. I mean, we discuss this on the stack all the time, but where the money comes from, you know, so you can't have those products for free. I mean, that's my view.
But Tom, why do you think more musicians haven't taken that stand? I mean, I know quite a lot of musicians, very few of them unfortunately sell as many records as Prince do, but they all hate it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's instructive to look at specific musicians, particularly people who are particularly creative when it comes to generating revenue. Now, Prince himself had a flirtation for a number of years with a kind of an early iteration of
this
the idea
true.
Of on-demand music. And then when he was publicly recognised for how innovative that was, he pulled the plug. David Bowie, another tragic recent departure, was another who effectively created a bond on his own future earnings. Very creative, made himself a lot of money. And they could justify that by talking about, yes, maybe, you know, the different quality of listening to music on vinyl or even on CD and not in a compressed file. But I think it's much more about protecting revenues. I'm sure there was something noble, and I'm sure Prince and Bowie and others were thinking about, you know, the little guy who didn't have to wrestle with the $100 million tax bills that they did. But fundamentally, and I think it is about protecting revenue. I would say that where the questions need to be asked is more fundamentally on that sort of primary level. You know, do enough profits of music go to music makers, music writers, musicians? Probably not. And that's a bigger question merely than the point of sale to the consumer.
It has always been a struggle to make money in music, and I've spoken to a couple of musicians who think that maybe, you know, decades down the track we'll end up regarding the period between the mid-50s and the mid-90s as the blip. That there was this sort of like strange, anomalous few decades in which you actually could get quite rich making music, because you couldn't beforehand and you can't really now, unless you are incredibly blessed. I mean, Fernando, does Prince's music appearing on streaming signal some sort of final victory over the old order? Is there really no chance anymore that musicians can rely on selling their work for a reasonable amount?
I think there will be a chance. You know, for example, look at the sales of vinyl. You know, they are increasing. So I think,
but there's still a tiny fraction of overall sales.
Absolutely, but it's still rising. And I think there will be a problem if websites like Spotify, for example, don't pay enough for its musicians. I mean, you had a recent case, I believe, with Taylor Swift, which she didn't have her songs on Spotify. I don't know what's the latest on that, but it was also like a criticism of the industry. I think we're going to see this more and more. I don't predict that, you know, now we're going to hear music for free on those streaming services without any sort of protest. Because, one thing that, for example, if you go to Spotify, you see like an image of Adele, Drake. It's very good for the big artists, you know. Mind you that I think the problem is with the minor ones, because it's very difficult to do research. I think those websites have more the casual listener. So, of course, they will click, okay, Drake's number one, let's listen to him. But what about the new bands?
Well, indeed, they are the ones who do struggle with it. It's not easy to make a living on 23 Spotify listens a month. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Furse. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Stay tuned for The Menu at 1900 with Marcus Hippie, and then The Cinema Show, chatting to the writer and director of the film 20th Century Women at 2000 London time. I've got more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend.